It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me. 2 days ago, I was in Budapest, and yesterday, I was in Paris, and today, I'm in Atlanta. Tomorrow, I fly to New York, and the day after, I fly to Israel. So in a week, I will have crossed the Atlantic 3 times. As I said, I'm delighted to be here, but frankly, I have no idea where here is. So I'm going to turn to one of the least free regions on the planet. The title of the session is Ordered Liberty in a Digital Age. I founded a group, and I direct it, called cyberdissidents.org, which supports pro-democracy internet activists in the Arab world and Iran. We attempt to make them famous in the West and champion their cause, make them loved and adored. And appreciated for their thoughts and their actions. I spent the last few years working for Natan Sharansky in Israel as his coordinator for democracy programs. And Sharansky was the deputy prime minister of Israel and spent 9 years in a Soviet gulag. And much of the work that we do, as the moderator said, is based on the experience of Sharansky and the global campaign that was waged on his behalf and on behalf of many Soviet dissidents. 3 years... In 1986, a Soviet dissident named Anatoly Marchenko died in Chistopol prison, the same prison that Sharansky was in. And I want to read you a brief quote about what Sharansky said about why his demands were listened to and why Marchenko's were ignored. He wrote, "In 1986, a Soviet dissident, Anatoly Marchenko, died in the infamous Chistopol prison after a long and futile hunger strike for improved conditions. 3 years earlier, I had gone on a similar hunger strike in the same prison and been subjected to the same torturous conditions by KGB thugs. But the authorities eventually gave in to my demands. Why? Because my 9 years of imprisonment were accompanied by a relentless worldwide campaign and steady, unambiguous pressure on the communist regime by leaders of the free world. The regime that knew it would pay a heavy price if I were to die. With Marchenko, it was confident that the world did not care enough to do more than mount a formal protest." That's the view from the Soviet dissident, but how do we know that this actually had an effect on the policymakers in the Soviet Union? The way we know that is by way of Erwin Kotler, who served as Justice Minister of Canada and a board member of Cyber Dissidents. And he told me the following anecdote. In 1997, he was honored at a dinner with Gorbachev in New York. And he went up to Gorbachev and he said, "There's a question that's been vexing me for years and I'd like your answer. I served as Sharansky's lawyer and I was opposed to his imprisonment from the beginning, but I want to know why you let him out of prison." And Kotler told me that he said the following thing, speaking through a translator. He said, "I never knew anything about Sharansky. I never even knew the name. I came to Canada as Minister of Agriculture, and I appeared before a Canadian Parliamentary Committee on Agriculture. But instead of getting questions about agriculture, I got questions about Sharansky. I left the Parliament building and saw placards of Sharansky. Wherever I went, I was confronted by Sharansky. So I came back to the Soviet Union, and I said, 'Who is this guy Sharansky?' I got the files and said, 'Well, he might be a troublemaker, but he isn't a criminal,' and so we ordered his release." I'm going to talk about the strategic challenges in a minute that cyber dissidents in the Arab world and Iran face, but just to show you the parallel, the chairman of cyber dissidents is a man by the name of Ahmed Batabi, who spent the last 8 years in prison in Iran and escaped recently with the help of a Kurdish group. Batabi tells the exact same story, but in Iranian context. He was the famous dissident who appeared on the cover of The Economist with a white bloodied shirt in 1999 as part of student uprisings. And the first time he appeared in front of a judge, the judge showed him the picture which he had never seen. And he said, "You have signed your own death warrant with this picture." It took Batabi 8 years of torture and imprisonment. And when he came out, he said that that picture actually saved his life because there were dissidents to his left and right that no one had ever heard about and no one had ever cared about who disappeared without a trace. So what my organization does is look at the, as I said, the strategic challenges that cyber dissidents face in the Middle East and attempts to help them overcome that and to champion their cause in the West. I got to speak at Google not long ago. I was at a Google conference in Budapest, but a few months before that in Washington. And I was in a room with 15 legitimate cyber dissidents, many of whom had spent time in prison from the Arab world. And I posed to them the following paradox. I said, "You have all the technology in the world, all the tools that have always been dreamt about with Twitter and Facebook, etc., and you can get your message to millions literally instantaneously. And yet there's not a single American in a million who knows any one of your names. Soviet dissidents who had to rely on samizdat, underground literature, you know, which essentially was the blog of the day. Vladimir Bukovsky defined it as, I write it, I edit it, I distribute it, I go to prison for it. In any case, the Soviets had a fraction of the power, and yet they had marches in Washington with 250,000 people calling for the release of Sharansky and Bukovsky and on behalf of Sakharov and many others. So what is it that modern Arab and Iranian cyber dissidents can learn from Soviet dissidents? And how are the challenges similar? The first challenge that I can identify is white noise, the overflow of information, as we all know. From 1950 to 1975, Johns Hopkins University identified about 1,500 pieces of samizdat literature that made it westward. You can imagine today there's about 1,500 pieces of samizdat literature coming from the Middle East every second. I mean, 30 million tweets a day and hundreds of millions of Facebook users and 90 trillion emails. A veritable deluge, overflow, tsunami of information. And you can imagine how difficult it is for someone who has little access to the internet, little training, little funds, to get his message out to policymakers and press in the West to show the world that people like that exist. The second strategic challenge is the fact that blogging and internet activism has almost become mundane. And if value is linked to scarcity, you have to take into account the fact that now anyone can become a cyber dissident with the snap of a finger. They can send out a tweet, and it's almost like dissent on the cheap. Sharansky described to me the difficult process of creating samizdat. It took years sometimes. You had to take physical photographs of literature and spread it hand to hand. And so when it came to the West, people knew the value of it. People knew that for years people had risked their lives to get this out to them. Whereas today, it's so much easier that you have to wonder, do people look at it differently? The third is the law of unintended consequences. To play devil's advocate for a moment, is it possible that the ease with which people use the internet today actually has a deleterious effect on the efficacy and on the boldness and on the character of dissent? I do what I normally do when I have such thoughts. I immediately go to my friends in the region who I'm in contact with a lot, from Egypt and Syria and Lebanon, etc., and I ask them what they think. I'd like to read you the thoughts of one very brave Egyptian blogger. When I asked her about this, she said, I think too much reliance on technology and the internet made young people in the Middle East unwilling to do the real work on the ground. They usually find difficulty in leaving the keyboard and doing real action. They can stay anonymous, but street work is tough. There in the streets, they might get arrested. They will face real opponents, flesh and blood. The keyboard is a safer weapon. Another Egyptian dissident said, Facebook movements won't amount to anything beyond joining Facebook movements. We see many examples of this. Campaigns of Al-Baradei in Egypt get hundreds of thousands of Facebook followers, and a few people will show up in the streets. Last November, there was a Facebook campaign in the city of Mukattam in Egypt, and only the Facebook organizer actually showed up to the protest. The internet alone is not enough to galvanize a real protest movement. So back to the Google paradox, the paradox I posed at Google. How is it that we can make cyber dissidents more famous, and what can they do? And I think there's one primary recommendation that I've come to in terms of studying this and dealing with people in the region, and that is to individualize the message of dissent. Part of the genius of the Soviet dissident movement, I believe, is because it was about Soviet Jews. It was about individual people. It wasn't about abstractions. It wasn't about a whole swath of interests. It oftentimes was about the posters of the man. I read the study of Paul Slovak at University of Oregon, professor of psychology, and he looked at what people respond to in terms of humanitarian crises and indifference in the face of humanitarian disaster. And he did the following study. He had three test groups, and to one test group he gave a list of the millions of people that had died in Africa from starvation, description of the problem. And he asked them how much money they'd be willing to give to this cause. To the second group, he gave a picture of a 7-year-old starving African child and asked how much they were willing to give to this girl. On average, people gave twice as much money of their allotted amount to the single face of the girl as opposed to the millions starving. Interestingly, he did a third test group where he added a 7-year-old girl from Mali, I believe, and a 7-year-old boy. And people gave less when confronted with two faces as opposed to a single face. In other words, the beginning of dissent, of caring, is the addition of a single person. I think a lot of dissidents in the Middle East forget this. If you take the April 6th movement in Egypt, a youthful, vibrant, dissident movement that talks about everything from bread prices to Camp David to torture to repression, all of it's lost on a Western audience. And I think they use the wrong rhetoric. They don't understand that editors, they don't understand that politicians here don't care about the bread prices in Egypt. The head of the founder of the April 6th movement was at this Google conference with me in Budapest, and we spoke about how she could better utilize the individual message to get her to get her ideas out to the West. I'd like to read you just briefly the comments of Karim Amer, who's now in his fourth year in prison in Egypt for criticizing the Egyptian dictator. He writes, "Let them imprison me if they wish. They will never rob anything from me, for my freedom exists inside me. They will never deprive me of it, regardless of how heavy their chains are or how narrow their cells are. I announce from my detention cell that nothing and no one will ever make me submit, even when my hands are in chains and my freedom of movement is denied. This will only make me stronger and more stubborn in my confrontation with the enemies of mankind." This, to me, is exactly what I read, exactly what Amalric says, exactly what Sakharov said, the immutable freedoms that exist within all mankind. And many dissidents in the Arab world and Iran fundamentally understand this. But when I think about the trouble they've had in communicating that to the West and telling their story, a few months ago I was in Turkey and I ran into a member of the first trade delegation to Libya. And I asked him what his thoughts were on Fatih al-Jahemi, the most famous Libyan dissident, bar none. And he said the following. He said, "Who?" The member of the first trade delegation to Libya had never heard of the most famous Libyan political prisoner who had just died 2 or 3 weeks prior. When I contrast this with the anecdotes from the Reagan administration, Doug Feith, for example, in every meeting with the Soviets when he was head of arms negotiations at the Pentagon, told the Soviets that the reason we can't trust you is because you violate treaties, and we see that in your treatment of Orlov, Sakharov, and Sharansky. I ran across a letter that President Reagan wrote to Brezhnev saying, "If there's one single thing that you need to do for me, I know we disagree on a lot of things," he wrote in 1981, "you have to release Natan Sharansky from prison." This is the kind of concerted effort that I think can come about if we can properly tune the rhetoric and we can properly help people in the region get their message to the West. I'll close with the following. I think that, as I said, a great many cyber dissidents recognize these fundamental facts. And if there's one message that we can get across to the policy community, it would be to go back to the Sakharov and Sharansky principles of the democracy that hates you is better than the dictatorship that loves you. And we must trust states only as much as they trust their own people. The way we can do this is by speaking clearly and properly about the true nature of tyranny. It is weakness masked in bravado often, I believe as Potter Stewart did, that censorship points to a society's lack of belief in its own system. And even though many people speak about tyranny and speak about it in terms of appeasement or stability and lots of other nice-sounding words, in a matter of fact, we have to never forget that it's fundamentally weak because it does not rely on consensual government. It does not rely on the ideas of the people. It's a top-down system. So when we look at cyber dissidents in the Middle East, I'll just leave you with the thought of an Egyptian friend of mine who spent a significant amount of time in prison. I asked him what he thought about the idea that stability should come first, that his message is often disregarded in the West, that people don't necessarily care about his struggle and his movement. And he said the following. I said, "What do you say to those who say that stability and development must precede democracy?" And I know there are some Arabic speakers in the room, so I'll say the line in Arabic. He said to me, "أقول لهم إنكم وهون وأغبياء لأن الديمقراطية هي التي تأتي بالاستقرار ولا يأتي الاستقرار بالديمقراطية." Which means, I say to them, you are delusional and stupid. And that democracy brings stability. Stability does not bring democracy. So we have to keep that in mind at all times and never forget the great statement of one of our founding fathers, who said that we must swear upon the altar of God eternal hostility against all forms of tyranny over the mind of man. Thank you.